Hello and welcome to the Gab and Jules podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. He's Julien Laurence. It's May 21st, Jules. Shall we give some happy birthday shouts?
Yes, it's not yours, it's not mine. That's all I know, but
no, that's original.
Who else? Who else is?
Well, born on this day, two people who are no longer with us, of course, and that would be Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. Notorious B.I.G. You were a fan, I'm sure. Yes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Jeffrey Dahmer, presumably you were less of a fan of his. But also, we have Ricky Williams, the former NFL phenom who decided that he didn't want to play anymore because he didn't like getting drug tested, among other reasons.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have, from the A-team, Mr. T.
Wow.
We'll be joined by Mark Ogden because this has been a week where there's been a lot of stuff happening in the Premier League and in the Premier League's return. We'll have the Alphabet 11. We'll have Quick Hits. So let's do this.
Let's go.
All right. At the top, we had Spain continuing, inching back towards a return. As Javier Tebas mentioned, they don't have an actual start date, but I think technically it could be any time after June 11th.
Yeah.
And I suspect it may well be either that weekend or the following weekend. We finally getting somewhere in Serie A, Jules.
We are indeed, Gab. Tell us more about it. May 28th seems to be the date when we will really know, but people are optimistic, right?
Yeah, so the sports minister, Vincenzo Spadafora, who had become this sort of hated figure in football circles, he's finally come around and said, well, you know, now that the situation has changed, you know, attitudes have changed, and, you know, now I think we can sit down and we can have a meeting. We're pretty much in agreement on anything, and we can have a meeting to make it official on May 28th. Now, part of me, when he said this, I'm like, okay, you absolute dolt. You said this on May 20th. Why can't you have the meeting tomorrow so we can actually move forward and get to work? Why you got to wait 8 days? You know, you're not actually meeting anybody. You're just Zooming each other. You're the minister of sport. This is literally the main thing that you do. But no, for whatever reason. So I think the key is obviously the clubs are back training in small groups as they are in the Premier League. Players are being tested. At that meeting, they're going to go through, they're going to approve both the medical protocol for phase two of training as well as the medical protocol for matches. So it does look like they're going to come back. But you know what? We've had so many false dawns. I think it's like a weird race between Serie A and the Premier League at this point. Who screwed things up the most on the pathway back? But it does look promising for both. So as fans, we're happy. And we're happy that we have Bundesliga. That was good last weekend, right?
That was really good. And we're all looking forward to this weekend again as well. Maybe people didn't tune last weekend. Maybe they would be more interested in the Borussia Mönchengladbach Bayer Leverkusen game or the Berlin Derby on Friday night. But it'd be very good. And again, there was some, we were wondering what kind of level we would see behind closed doors with players who hadn't played for 9 or 10 weeks or something like that. And actually, you could always argue that technically could have been a bit better, and yes, there was no atmosphere and that kind of thing. But if you look at numbers and just at purely numbers, and again, the sample is very small because it's only the one weekend that we had last week compared to everything since the start of the season. But before the break and after the break, actually, it was similar amount of sprints, a similar amount of running, probably. So physically, they were quite up for it. The intensity was quite similar. If you look at all the sprints and everything, there was a little bit less dribbling, a little bit less tackles as well, maybe less shootings too and touches in the box, but not massively less than before. What was very interesting though is that if you look at game in play time, so when the ball was in play and not out of play, there was much more than before the break. And partly because players didn't really argue with referees, and referees, I don't think, maybe blew as much as before, maybe because there was not the pressure from the fans, from the stadium, that kind of atmosphere. It looks like there was more freedom on the pitch from referees and from players. And if you take out all the times where players talk to referees answer back, et cetera, if there was not much of that, then
there was
more football.
There you have it, ladies. Julien Laurence arguing that football on television is better without fans.
No!
Gladbach-Leverkusen, the biggest game on Saturday. You know my Peter Boss feelings, but then you also know my Kai Havertz feelings. I would like Gladbach to win because I want to see, you know, a race. And I think Marco Rosa came out of the gate very, very quickly.
Yeah.
They should handle this, yeah?
They should, although Leverkusen looked really good against Werder Bremen on Monday night, albeit it was only Werder Bremen, but they've got so much depth in their squad, Bayer. If you look at who Peter Bosch, your friend, brought in that game late, Leon Bailey and Belarabi, who gave a wonderful assist on the fourth goal by Demir Bay. So I like Bayer Leverkusen's squad, especially going forward. Defensively, maybe not so much, but going forward is great. I love Charles Aranguiz, who is such a wonderful ball player. But you're right. I think Gladbach, especially at home, if you want to still call it like that, should have enough. But it would be a great game. You could expect, again, very open game, a lot of goals, both teams that look more to attack than to defend, really. So if you think the form that Thuram and Player had in their game at the weekend, it would be very good, I think.
All right. Dortmund away to Wolfsburg. This is your chance, of course, to see the beast Erling Braut Haaland. We're going to talk about him a little bit later on as well. Bayern home to Eintracht Frankfurt, which could get ugly given the way they looked last week. On Friday night, the Berlin Derby, which matters a lot to our producer, Freddie Arrington. Yeah. And then, of course, on Sunday, Leipzig, it's got to be plus win. It's a must win for them, right? They're away to Mainz. It might not make a difference, but I just like watching them play.
They're great. And you're right on Monday when we talked to Jan Agger about their game, which has been quite a pattern this season where they play really well. They create a lot of chances. If Patrick Schick scores the second one in the 85th minute, they win that game and they deserve to win. And everybody says they played so well. But Freiburg got efficient, scored a very lucky goal, and then it was hard for Leipzig to just capitalize on their dominance. And I think it's a shame that, you know, again, they don't have someone who then can score those very, very important goals late in the game like she could have done.
All right, now, I wrote a column. It's up on the website because I was struck by the last dance. I know we've talked about it. We've both been watching it. It resonated so far around the world. I mean, we're both in London. It's carried internationally by Netflix, and it is in ESPN co-production. You had everybody from Giorgio Chiellini everybody seemed to have an opinion on this.
Yeah.
And the one question I kind of wrestled with in the piece is, you know, was whether you could have a football version of Jordan. I mean, like the whole package, right? Not just somebody who is so dominant, not somebody who makes the club relevant, not just somebody who has all the drive and intensity, not just somebody who has those somewhat controversial motivational techniques towards his teammates. And the conclusion I reach is that it's simply impossible. I mean, you're on board with that, right?
Yeah. For me, there's two aspects. The first one is the leadership, that which includes the bullying to his own, you know, to his own teammates. This happens in football. Thierry Henry was not to that degree, but could be quite tough at times with some of the players because he had high demands. When he was training, people had to be at his level, and it was not possible for some of them to be at Thierry Henry's level, but that's what he wanted. And he knew that if he had that sort of degree of excellence and that he was, you know, pushing other players and transmitting that, then everybody would be better. I think Ibra, and in your piece, I think that's what, when I read it, that's what, even before you mentioned Ibra's name, for me, watching The Last Dance, Ibra was a bit like this when he was at PSG and even to other clubs. And we saw some of his former LA Galaxy saying that he was really rude. He was bullying players at training and stuff like that in his own team. So I think on that level, Ibra is not too far from that in the sense that he wanted the best out of everyone, winning at all costs. Like Jordan says, you do anything to win, even if that means insulting your own teammates, pushing them, making life difficult for them, except being on their case all the time. And I think Ibra has a bit of that in him, right?
But yeah, I would agree. I think, I mean, the point I made where it's different is obviously Jordan, you know, until he came back, the second time, Jordan spent his entire career at the Chicago Bulls. Jordan put the Bulls on the map in terms of as a global brand. And he had so much sporting capital at the club. And he was like that the whole time he was in Chicago. The thing about Ibra is, I would argue Ibra sort of became that way. Ibra had like 8 different clubs by the time he was 30.
Yeah.
So when he arrived at PSG, he was, you know, their biggest signing. So he had that kind of influence and maybe could behave that way a little bit. But I also think Ibra, at that stage of his career, you know, We excuse a lot of things of players when they get older. When they're younger and they act like that, you tend to think, yeah, you're kind of something that, you know, rhymes with stick. And that's it. You know, Ibra, when he was younger, was more of a loner. And I think when he got older, he sort of embraced the Ibra character, the lone wolf and all this stuff. True. But, you know, he never had that kind of influence over a club, you know, except for those few years. And even then it came from Nasser and the people invested so much. But by that point, he was in his, you know, he was what, 32, 33 years old.
No, you're right, but there were still some similarities. You know, he got a chef sacked in Paris because the food was not to his taste. You know, that kind of stuff. He would park in front of the main gate so no one could come in or come out until he got the right place he wanted on the car park. That kind of stuff. There was, when I watched The Last Dance, there was a reminiscence of what Ibra was like in Paris compared to what Jordan was in Chicago. Different context and all of that. But the other very important point that you make in the piece as well is the impact that Jordan had on his own team, obviously, on basketball in general, but also outside of sports, you know, with Nike and all of that. And you said that in football, that just is not possible. Or at least that no one in football had reached that kind of level. Not even Messi and Ronaldo.
Well, I made a point that certainly within U.S. athletes, if you're talking global sporting icons, the only one I would put alongside him, possibly even ahead of him, is Muhammad Ali. Then nobody else comes close. So it's funny. It generated a ton of debate on social media.
Yeah, so Gary Lineker.
Gary Lineker.
Jumped in as well with Tiger Woods.
The other thing which I think is worth underscoring is that as powerful as Ronaldo and Messi are, the bullying side of it simply isn't there. You know, we see them throw up their arms on the pitch, but that's all that happens. Yeah, I mean, we've been around enough of their teammates and coaches to say it's not like that. I would also dispute, certainly in Cristiano's case, the power that he has over the club. And I think this is important because the Bulls before Jordan really were pretty insignificant. Real Madrid was very important before Cristiano got there. And I'm sure Cristiano was very well paid and got his way on many things. But remember, Cristiano didn't want Carlo Ancelotti sacked. He probably wanted Mourinho to leave earlier. He didn't want Rafa Benitez to come at all. And yet all these things happened. And in the end, his final years at Real Madrid, it was always that case where, you know, do I extend the contract? Should I go? Blah, blah, blah. You know, he didn't bully the club. You know, the club was still the club. And I'd argue with Messi as well. I know right now we all make it seem as if, you know, oh, Messi dominates Barcelona and everything. I'm like, yeah, but let's think about what Messi wants, right? Messi wants Neymar. And guess what? Neymar's not back, you know? Messi supposedly, you know, you're hearing different things. Messi wants Lautaro. Messi wants this. Messi wants that. It's very easy to go and dump things on Messi, right?
Yeah.
But I think Messi's treated the way you treat a veteran player who's arguably the best player in the world. But I don't know that, you know, Barcelona will still be around and still be relevant once Messi's gone. So it's just a very different dynamic.
True, but you could also say that Jordan lost against the Bulls in the end and against, you know, against Jerry Krause, because he would have liked to stay another year. He would have liked everybody, including Pippen, including Steve Kerr, who both were traded after Jordan left. He wanted, obviously, to keep Phil Jackson. And Krause said no. And he could have won, but clearly Krause and the Bulls thought they were bigger than Jordan, and they let him go and everybody else go as well.
His organizations win championships, right? All right, shall we move on from this and take it into the present and bring in the smiling Mark Ogden? All right, Jules, let's jump in because I think it's the Premier League where there's been the most movement this week. And look, to brighten our day, it's Mark Ogden. And Mark Ogden, you're smiling, you're happy because you have some good news for us. Teams are back in training, albeit weirdo training, but that's fine because that's a necessary first step, right?
Back in training, back in non-contact training, groups of five. We've all had the test this week, so it's been initially 19 out of 20 clubs were tested, so 748 tests, 6 positives, so I think that's less than 1%. So it's probably a good outcome for the Premier League and Project Restart, as we have to call it.
Who hasn't been tested?
Well, Norwich hadn't been tested, but they have been now. They were tested.
We don't know the results, right?
No, they're going to be announcing the next batch, which is the weekend. So, you know, make sense of that if you can.
Why can't they update the results now? And so we can have a complete picture.
Well, I mean, I'd be up for it being announced at the 5 o'clock briefing every day at Downing Street. You know, it's almost like a scorecard, isn't it? A Premier League tests and positives. But no, that's the Premier League protocol. That's the way they're doing it. So if they announced it now, it'd be kind of difficult to keep this kind of level of secrecy or keep it under wraps. If they said, well, we've had six positive tests, but we can't say where they're from. Well, we all know that Norwich have tested today. So, you know, they have to be careful.
I have another question, which is purely purely math-related question, just about the testing. I know we'll get into the big testing news, but each club has a testing pool of 40 players, which, as I understand it, is, okay, Premier League is saying, all right, we'll pay for the test of 40 people. It's its players and its staff, right? And I know that some clubs complain that said, like, oh, we've got a bazillion assistants and physios and 50 kit men or whatever. That's fine. You can only test 40. I would assume that every single club tested its full allocation of 40 people, because it'd be kind of dumb, right? Not to. So there's 40 times 20 is 800. There are 52 tests left over. Mm-hmm. I presume 40 of those tests will go to Norwich. What happened to the other 12 tests?
Oh my God.
Has anybody asked them? No. Well, honestly,
maybe some clubs have 39 or 38. Yeah, so that's too.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. I mean, I was speaking to somebody at a club that hasn't been given a test, so he wasn't in the initial 40. From Friday, it's going to go up to 50, but the first 40 was basically, he rattled it off to me, it was 25 players, 5 coaching staff, I think it had 6 medical staff and 4 video analysts. But some clubs will probably just want to keep it to a tighter group, so they may decide rather than have 40, they'll have a 35 group, because they don't need, I mean, I'd imagine some clubs at the bottom end of the table have a smaller staff. I mean, look at Man City's staff. They have about 400 staff on the bench every game, so I don't know how they decide who gets the test, but clubs further in the league have a smaller staff, so it may be a case that they don't need 40 people to be tested. They want to keep it to a smaller group, so that's how I view it.
I don't understand why. I mean, I suppose it makes sense, but I just don't understand why. Especially if you're going to be playing so many games in such a tight period, why you wouldn't add some youth team guys, why you wouldn't take advantage of the full allocation. But look, if that's the case, I do. I was just wondering if maybe it wasn't at all possible that you actually had 12 tests that were inconclusive, or maybe more tests that were inconclusive.
Who knows? The Premier League haven't told us, but I agree. It is odd that each club has 40 allocated and there weren't 40. Even my maths was able to work that one out.
Augie, so even if training was allowed to resume in small groups, as you said, no contact, etc., there's still some players who don't fancy going back training. Troy Deeney has publicly said that he has a baby at home who had breathing difficulties when he was born, etc., and he doesn't feel safe enough to go back training, even in small groups. N'Golo Kanté went back training for the first day with Chelsea, but then again had a chat with Frank Lampard saying that he doesn't feel safe enough to come back training, so they've given him a few days off as well for as long as he feels like before coming back training. So there's still an issue of players feeling safe or not safe enough to go back training.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really difficult one to address, isn't it? Because every player will have their concerns. We know that, you know, statistics have shown that, you know, people from black and ethnic minority groups are more likely to contract coronavirus. The statistics are there. It's a clear thing. And I think obviously Troy Deeney and N'Golo Kanté fit into that category. So they're concerned about the issues. They haven't been reassured that everything will be safe. You know, from what I've been told, that working or training at a Premier League football club is going to be one of the safest environments you could possibly work in right now. And there are people.
Did the Premier League say that?
No, but you can see by the protocols. I mean, you know, people that are going to work at a superstore or a, you know, in an office block or on a building site, they're not having these safety protocols. And this is an issue that football has to be careful of, because, you know, football is always used as a, you know, a punchbag, really. People said they're doing it right, they're doing it wrong. Now, if footballers are perceived to be wanting special treatment, that it's not safe for them to come back, but it's safe for 90% of the population to do so, who don't have the luxury of being on, you know, multi-thousand pound salaries a week, they're going to lose a lot of goodwill. So every player has the right to say they don't feel safe. But I do think that if they consider the protocols and the safety and the lack of contact, it's as safe as it can be. And football has never been a risk-free sport. And I think, listen, I totally accept Troy Deeney's issue. He's got a young son who, you know, potentially could be harmed by it. And N'Golo Kanté, I think there's been issues in the past where he, you know, his family members as well have died young. So absolutely, every player has the individual right to do this, but I do think as a whole, it can't be much safer than it is.
I would tend to agree with you there. Jules, and I think Jules is in agreement too. We've made this point before. If you're not up for it, I think there's an easy solution. And I think clubs have to be sensitive to it as well. And just simply say, okay, fine. Unpaid leave and off you go. I mean, that's how I would handle it as a club. You would be respectful of it. And I think, you know, both Troy Deeney and N'Golo Kanté could be satisfied of it. Now, there's six tests in all, six positives out of 748. That is around, 0.8%. It's a tiny bit higher than the pool that we had in the Bundesliga, which I think was 0.6%. But that's encouraging. I mean, if these tests are accurate, then it does show that if you can keep that pool contained, we're in relatively good shape. How confident are you and how confident are clubs that, you know, over the next 6 weeks, players are going to continue to self-isolate away from the training ground, right? Because let's just remind people, they're not in this little bubble. They're not in that crazy two-month quarantine that we talked about before.
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? I mean, football is like any kind of cross-section of society whereby some will, you know, stick to it to the letter. I mean, I think Adrian Mariappa was one of the positive tests, and he's come out and said that he can't believe he's positive because he's done nothing during the lockdown apart from stay at home with his kids and had the, you know, a couple of trips to the shops. But other players, as we know, have been a bit more, have taken more risks, shall we say, that they've traveled to different countries and they've invited people around to their flats and gone out. So, you know, not everyone's going to stick to the rules that they should do. So, players will get bored. Some will transgress, as we know. Some will get the haircut when they're not allowed to, as we know. So there will probably be more positive tests. But look, I think as well, it's interesting to note in London, I think the last 48 hours, there haven't in the whole of London, there haven't been any more positive or certainly people tested positive for COVID. So that is suggesting that in London, that the virus has not been wiped out, but it's incredibly, you know, rare now. So if that pattern travels the country as well, the next 4 to 6 weeks, you might see a case where it comes down to a much lower rate. So we'll see. But yeah, in terms of footballers staying in and sticking to the quarantine, some will break the quarantine, obviously.
You know what I thought was really interesting in what Troy Deeney had to say, apart from the fact that he explained the situation with his son, etc. At the end, he also said, I've got loads of questions and no one is giving me any answers. And we go back again to the same point. And I know every week we say the same, but about the protocol and what's going to happen if they go back to playing and all of that. And I think Deeney is right when he says, I can't get a haircut until July, but then you expect me to go and challenge the ball in a corner where there's 20 of us in the box, touching each other, grabbing the shirts, like, you know, being next close to each other, which is right. And I think until there's a proper answers given to those players, the ones who are not really sure or a bit on the fence, they won't go anywhere. And those people like Kanté and Deeney right now probably feels like, I would like to go back playing, but no one is telling me exactly what's going to happen. I can't take the risk, so I would rather stay away.
The big problem, I think, is going forward, because I was in a conference call with the Premier League on Monday, and their medical officers were saying that from conversation with Public Health England, they've been told that this situation, the current now, is going to last between 6 to 12 months. So we could have this situation, you know, next April or May. Are the likes of Troy Deeney and N'Golo Kanté going to take a year off? If there are still no answers, what happens at the start of next season? Do they continue to say, I don't think it's safe to play? Because that is a bigger issue for me, that long term, are people going to expect footballers to stay locked away for a year if they're not up for it? You know, when everyone else is working, at some point there has to be an element of, well, you know, life isn't risk free. You know, as long as the risks are minimized, well, then you go back. But again,
I think if you're talking in general terms, well, first of all, when people say like, well, it's going to be like this for 6 to 12 months, I'm like, oh, gee, thank you. Captain Obvious, there could be a vaccine tomorrow or it could be no vaccine for 10 years. What the hell? I mean, like, I know that I love that. I'm not making fun of the scientists and whatever, but all this crap that we've heard from people, like, you know, they simply don't know, right? They really have no idea. So, yeah, that is a possibility. If you feel that football becomes too dangerous for you to do, dangerous physically for you, for your well-being, for your families, then you don't do it. Then you walk away. Then we deal with it. But I don't think you can have one size fits all. There are people who go and willingly do dangerous jobs because they're really highly paid jobs, right? Or because they really enjoy them or they get a thrill out of it. We live with that. maybe football will become one of those jobs. The most important thing, and this is what the Premier League's been working at, is that in doing those jobs, they're not just putting their own health and life and welfare at risk. The key is that they don't spread contagion to other people who don't have a choice in the matter. So I personally, look, if it remains like this and there's people who just don't want to play, if N'Golo Kanté decides I want to retire, that's fine. That's his choice. I mean, I have no problem with it. Football's still going to survive. There's still going to be people who are willing to play. And our job should be, or the Premier League's job should be, let's put them in the conditions where they can't infect other people and spread this. Because really, that is what it's all about, right?
Yeah, football can't wait for the outliers to say they're ready to play. They can't be, you know, held up by two or three players. Yeah. And as sad as it is, you know, that's going to have to happen. They're going to have to say, look, we've made it as safe as possible for you. Now it's your choice. If you want to take a year off unpaid, a lot of footballers could afford to do that quite easily. Easily. They could never work again in their life. But, you know, the average guy in the street has a much starker choice. They have to go back to work. So, you know, 6 months, a year's time, 10 years, like you say, Gab, it could disappear next week, it could be around for another 10 years, who knows? But I think when it gets to footballers having to choose, it's their choice and they can't expect to be paid as footballers if they don't play.
What I think is less acceptable, and that's what I found really concerning about Deeney, was he said he had all these questions and he didn't have answers for it. Now, I am not a scientist, but I've read the papers, I've listened to what people have said in other countries, and I haven't found a single person, for example, that has said the virus is spread when people sweat on each other. And yet, every time that people bring this up, oh, crowded penalty table, they're all sweaty. It doesn't matter how freaking sweaty they are. It really doesn't matter. But you could have a whole, you could bathe in coronavirus and you wouldn't get it. It's not transmitted that way. I don't understand why, and I think this is where we in the media, we have to be clever and say, okay, we're not scientists, but we can read, we can inform ourselves, and we can inform other people and inform Troy Deeney. You know, his risk is that somebody sneezes on him or breathes on him or touches his nose and then puts his finger in Troy Deeney's face. That is the risk for Troy Deeney. It's not somebody sweating on him.
No, but we live in a world, don't we, Gav, where people we live in a world now where the Project Fear rules, isn't it? And the scary element of life is one that people cling to. And I think you're right; it's a respiratory disease, so you can't get it through sweating. But you do a vox pop in the streets, and about if you speak to 50 people, 40 wouldn't even know that.
Yeah, that's I think that's one of the many failings in why people feel unsafe. Jules, unless you have another question on the dynamics of this, I wanted to go on to the other two elephants in the room. One is neutral grounds. So a week ago, you and I disagree on this, but we were all optimistic and saying, okay, the police is going to reverse their policy. The former chief policeman said neutral grounds were not necessary. They all had positive conversations. Both the government and the Premier League seemed to be on the same side. And I thought, okay, fine. They're going to change their mind about this. A week later, this issue's still up in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, nothing's been solved. You know, the police, the government haven't changed anything.
Are they meeting? Are they talking to each other? Or
yeah, they're speaking twice a week. DCMS, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, are meeting the Premier League and EFL regularly. And within that, you know, there will be discussions with the police, the emergency services. But you're right, nothing has been resolved. And, you know, I did a piece the other day about how Project Restart is moving along slowly, but none of the big issues have been resolved. And one of the biggest issues is where they're going to play. Nobody, at this stage, 3 weeks before the June the 12th staging post, 3 weeks before that, nobody knows where or when or how football is going to be played in the Premier League.
And just so I'm clear on this, there's no way the government can go and tell the police, guys, this is how we're going to do it. You guys work for us. Nor can they even tell the police, let's make this, as it normally is with safety decisions, right? It's a local decision for a local police authority to make, because the situation in say Norwich might be different from the situation in North London, for example, right?
Well, had the mayor of Liverpool said, was on record 2 weeks ago saying that he doesn't think it's safe for Liverpool to play against Anfield. And he's the head of the authority in Liverpool.
If the reason is only because they're scared that fans would gather outside the stadium, if that's the only reason or the main reason, surely that's not enough. Because as we saw in Germany, there was no one outside the stadium. If you tell people, you can trust people in this country as well to say, like, listen, you understand that it would be wrong to all come outside the stadium, 2,000 of you or 3,000 or whatever, even if Liverpool win the title at some point somewhere, just don't do it. People won't do it. So if that's the only reason, it's just crazy.
It's politics, Jules, isn't it? It's not about fan control. It's about a mayor thinking, right, out of my budget has to come the policing costs for I have to have more police on duty, more emergency services. And it all boils down to self-interest in politics as well, doesn't it? So I imagine it's a case of, right, who's going to pay for this? Oh, it's going to have to be us. Right, we're not having it.
I'd have less of a problem if it was a local issue. You know, I can understand that to some degree, a local police force with local knowledge, local budgets. But I just don't understand why the minute it becomes a national decision, why at that point the government doesn't have the authority to step in and say, guys, we've decided, we're the government, we were elected by the people, we have as many scientists and experts as you have, do things our way. That's just the part which I don't understand, but you're right. Maybe it is politics.
Well, that's one for the Home Office to decide. And the issue
it's her PC plod who's decided for the whole country.
Yeah, but the issue is, if the Home Office decides that they should tell the police to go back, then when the public inquiry happens years down the line and all the minutes are checked, the people responsible will be the government, and the last thing they want to be is held responsible, so they will pass it on to somebody else. And the police won't be held responsible because something might go wrong. So it's all a case of, well, who can be responsible in case it goes wrong? And nobody wants to put their hand up for that.
Okay, now educate me on the other bit. We mentioned they're not called phases. In Spain, they're called phases. Here in England, because you guys have to be different, they're called steps. But it's essentially the same thing. Step one, non-contact training. Step two, full contact training. Now, as I understand it, the soonest you can go to step two, which is full contact normal training, is June 1st, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
probably June the 2nd, considering that the government will have to tell us on June the 1st. So, you know, that's another big pushback.
It's true. Good point. Good point. June the 2nd. But, of course, to do that, you have to approve the protocol for step two. That hasn't been approved yet.
Yeah.
Why has that not been approved yet?
Well,
like, who's arguing this? Who's not? Who's...
Well, there are two more meetings next week, Tuesday and Wednesday. The meeting on Tuesday is to discuss the protocols. And again, it's involved with government, it's involved with the clubs, it's involved with the PFA, it's involved with all sorts of elements that want their say and want to make sure that somebody else ultimately takes the decision so they're not held to blame if it goes wrong. So next Tuesday, there'll be a protocol meeting where they can hopefully green light step two. Thursday, there's another meeting which they're hoping to green light the planned return date of games. But again, that's going to be provisional because they can't make any hard and fast decisions until June the 1st, until the government say, we are now entering a different phase of lockdown. So, you know, they're still aiming for June the 12th, which I think is massively optimistic now, considering it's 3 weeks tomorrow, or 3 weeks on Friday. I don't know how they're going to get that one through, but that's still the so-called staging post they're looking at.
Why does he stick with this June 12th thing? Is it just to put pressure on? Because... I mean, we've had managers come out and say this, right? If June 2nd is the first day that they can actually train, to then have somebody play on June 12th means that presumably they're not going to train on match day and only do light training the day before. Mm-hmm. We're talking, what, 8 days of full training? How do you expect to play football safely when you have 8 days? I mean, can we take it as read that this is just nonsense and posturing, and in reality, a more realistic start date is June 19th? If not June 26th?
I think June 26th. If clubs and coaches stick to this, we need 5 weeks of training. I think 5 weeks is probably too much. But if they get four, I still think you're looking at end of June. I mean, my personal view is that if everybody starts a starting line at the same kind of, you know, state of readiness after 3.5 weeks training, then they have to accept that. Nowadays, how often do footballers get the full period of rest during a summer? You know, I think every time there's a tournament, they get 2 or 3 weeks rest or break. So these guys haven't been, you know, hitting the lager and the Pringles during the lockdown. They'll still be in decent shape. Well, some might do. But they'll still be in a decent shape of fitness. I think if everybody has to give up something or make allowances, if they have to come back after 3 weeks training, tough. They're all been in the same boat. Let's get it on and get it done, and let's, you know, let's accept that you can't have the perfect scenario. It's like the light Olympic athletes who must train every day for 4 years. If they miss a day's training, it's going to cost them a medal. Sometimes you have to accept that it's not a perfect world. If we're all going to train for 3 weeks, you're all decent fitness anyway. There might be the odd chance of muscle strain, but that happens at the start of seasons anyway. They're never fully fit at the start of the season. So they need to stop asking for the perfect scenario. It isn't going to happen.
All right. There you go. You heard it from Augie. No yeah. perfect scenario for you. And then, I mean, look, I hope you're right. I just looking at the number of muscular injuries that they had in the Bundesliga after that. 1 week of games, I'm asking myself, if since the Premier League is basically going to be a giant television show to keep us entertained, is it how entertaining is it going to be if
but you're going to get your five subs, Gav, so it's going to be fine. You know, you've won your day. You're like, it's a knockout. You know, the players coming on and going all the time. What's going to happen? What will happen if a decisive goal is scored in the 90th minute by the fifth substitute? How are you going to feel then if a team gets relegated on the back of that?
I will feel vindicated because common sense will have prevailed. Augie, thank you so much.
Cheers, guys.
All right, enough, Augie. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer gave an interview to United We Stand, the iconic Manchester United fanzine, and said there are, quote, no bad apples at his club, and that he'd rather have a hole in his team than an A-hole. see what he did there?
Yeah.
You're not going to argue with him, are you, Jules?
No, I'm not. I'm not, Gavin. I think for all the criticism that he had got at some point when he arrived, and you could always debate it and his tactical abilities and all of that. The one thing that he did for sure in that team is that he came back in the dressing room and brought a lot more happiness and a much better team spirit. And I think he deserves credit for that. And that's exactly what he explains in that interview. Yeah. And I think he's right. I think sometimes one or two players or attitudes or behaviors in a dressing room could cause you a lot of trouble, you know, and could be really negative for the whole atmosphere and everything. And I think he'd be glad not to have that. And he'd be glad to have found a dressing room that he brought a bit more happiness back to it and that responded very well to it.
Yeah, Paul Ince, of course, still disagrees because Paul Pogba remains the source of all evil at the club. But this is wonderfully reminiscent of your buddy and my buddy, Leonardo, when he became a boss of Inter. And he said, we have a new policy. I call it the hugs and kisses policy, which worked to some degree for a short while anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, when you say hello and speak to people when you arrive at your training ground, suddenly things are a bit better, you know. Right, Manchester City's hearing at the Court of Arbitration for Sport is finally set for June 8th to June 10th. Gab, what are the implications? And remind us a bit of the background to it.
Yeah, so this is Manchester City. UEFA have fined them guilty of breaching financial fair play regulations. This is way back in 2014. And then misrepresenting facts, basically, and cooking the books. Manchester City dispute this. This all came out because of the Football League's revelations. Finally, this is the hearing where CAS essentially has several options. They can either do what judges and lawyers sometimes do, which is why I don't like them, say, oh, well, we don't have jurisdiction, more information, and just say we don't. And send it back to UEFA and the club financial control body to figure it out. They can reduce the punishment. They can negate the punishment and rule that Manchester City are innocent. Manchester City say they have irrefutable evidence. They could rule that City have, in a sense, already been punished because there's a bit of a statute of limitations on this. So a lot of things, I think, are in play. And I think it's going to be interesting what happens on June 10th or whenever they come up with their verdict, because obviously if Manchester City are banned, they would not be playing in the Champions League next season, and that would mean that the fifth place team in the Premier League would go and represent the Premier League. So that would be good news for the Sheffield United and Manchester Uniteds and Wolves and Chelsea's of this world. There's a bit more. Bit more wiggle room. Even Arsenal, right?
Yeah,
there you go.
Big repercussion. And again, we didn't think maybe that we would know so early in the summer, in the season. We thought maybe it would be later and stuff, but it's actually coming quite quickly now.
Third time lucky for Serge Aurier, as he once again is accused of violating social distancing rules. This time, he put pictures of himself on social media getting a haircut. Jules, he's your boy.
He's my boy, and I, you know, obviously made a mistake breaking the rules of lockdown. He, indeed, his barber came to his house, to his flat, he justified it by saying that he was negative. He's negative. He'd been tested. He's negative. So was his barber. There was no risk. He did a haircut and then left. And they had protection and everything so that you can get off his bike. I still think that you need to follow the rules, Serge. And again, you did it before and you do it again and you're in trouble with your club and some of your teammates probably. And that's just not a good thing.
This guy's just such a freaking knucklehead, man. Keep a low profile, dude.
The head of German affairs, Fritz Keller, says that it's time to talk about salary cap in football. Gab, is he right? And is this really realistic to do so?
Well, I have a whole column on this coming up in the next 48 hours on the website. In a nutshell, this is hugely, hugely problematic. And he's talking salary cap. Presumably, he's not talking about U.S.-style NFL salary cap where everybody can spend the same because, I mean, that opens a gigantic can of worms. He's basically talking about, you know, perhaps making wages a percentage of turnover since wages are really the only – you know, but they're the biggest cost for most clubs. So if you limit that, then you know that you're going to break even. So first and foremost, I think this might be illegal under a lot of employment law. But secondly, the biggest thing to remember about this is you can't do it in a vacuum, right? So if you're going to do this in the Bundesliga and then you don't do it in other leagues, then players are just going to leave and go to those leagues and you're going to undermine your competitive advantage. The other problem with this is, if you do it this way, you will create a situation where if Bayern Munich have, I don't know, eight times the revenue of Freiburg, they'll be able to spend eight times as much on players. And that's really going to go and sort of ossify, as the term is, the power relations and make leagues. And then we're going to maintain this enormous imbalance that we have. Now, I know some will say financial fair play does the same thing, but at least that's based on losses, and at least there are exceptions to it. So,
yeah,
look at it, study it, and then say, no, there's got to be better ways, like transparency, like financial oversight, like perhaps cash reserves to go and make sure football remains a stable business. Chelsea were hoping to persuade Olivier Giroud to stick around for a few weeks after the end of next month when his contract expires. Jules, did they succeed?
They did succeed, Gab. They extended his contract from another year, so 2020-2021, which is what they wanted as well, because, like you said, that covers post-June 30th, which he would have been out of contract. So it's easier done like this. That doesn't mean that he will still be there next season. They could still sell him if they want to. If he wants to go, they can find an agreement or whatever. But at least he will be there until the end of this current season and maybe next season as well. I think Lampard is happy with his professionalism and he's been very good. He's a very good teammate to have in a dressing room. He did well when he played eventually, especially the game against Spurs at Stamford Bridge. So I think he made a lot of sense. Because the Euros has been postponed, he will need to play. He will need to play in the year next season before the Euros. He knows that. So let's see what happens there with Tammy Abraham at the club and maybe other strikers coming in or something. So be interesting, but at least this is sorted and whenever the season restarts and is being played, the end of the season, he will be there for Chelsea. Well, it's a bridge too far for legendary Athletic Bilbao striker Aris Aduriz. When La Liga returns, he won't be sticking around. He's getting a hip replacement, which is what happens when you're old, Gab. But what a player he was, really.
Hey, it's just such a great story. You said 39 years old, you know, comes back, scores tremendous goals. I think he won his first cap in like 2010. And then he didn't win another cap for 9 years. He really is the example of the guy who blooms young and then for whatever reason doesn't work out. And then he comes back a real cult hero, a great guy, scorer of important goals, and shows that if you take care of yourself, you know, you can play really, really late. And a hip replacement is what happens in your 70s, right? When you get osteoporosis. This is not the case here. We shouldn't make fun of him.
You've been playing football since you were 16.
When you put your body through that, yeah. So, great guy, and I hope there's a role for him going forward.
Only player to score 5 goals in a Europa League game, by the way. He had an incredible night, if you remember, with Bilbao.
Among other things, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Roberto Martinez, or Martinez, as he's known in England, has extended his contract with the Belgian FA since there's no Euros. Makes sense, right, Jules?
I guess so. I'm not a fan. Okay, I'm not a fan. I know he did some good things at the World Cup, and I know you're going to defend him and this and that. I'm not super keen. He's better than Vilmots, who they had before. I give you that. I'm just not sure that he can win them a Euros or World Cup, even with the incredible generation of players that he has. But let's hope so. So we will see. But you're right. He's extended until 2022. So, you know, there will be a Euros and a World Cup, and then after that, we can see a bit more what he's achieved with that team. But yeah, I've got a few issues. I guess you don't, right? He's a lovely guy. I mean, as a manager.
It is what it is. He grows. I think it would have been really harsh to go and, you know, not extend it when he's not been playing.
Yeah.
What body of work you have to judge him on.
Gab, the Catalan media insists with the Pjanic and Lautaro stories. Rakitic says he still loves Sevilla. Arthur doesn't want to go anywhere. He wants to stay, which doesn't make things easier either. Could things be coming together on that front somehow, somewhere?
I don't know. This is such a mess. I think it's hilarious that, or it's not hilarious, it's weird that the only club that's just beating the transfer drum continuously, incessantly, are Barcelona. Now, the heart of this, it seems that it's actually Juventus, where the thing is Maurizio Sarri looks at his midfield and says, yeah, none of this. Now, this is the reason we weren't great this year, haven't been great so far this year. So Rabiot, bye-bye, get some money in for him, Aaron Ramsey, if anybody will take him, and his stupid wages. Pjanic, hey, any takers? And Pjanic is middleman offered to Barcelona. Barcelona say, like, oh, yeah, look, the guy can pass the ball. Sure, we'll take him. Pjanic, of course, so happy to go to Barcelona. Sarri's plan is like, perfect. We'll just swap Pjanic for Archer, who, in Sarri's mind, Archer can be like what he had with Alan at Napoli. Because, of course, they're both Brazilian and their names are both first names, right? So, in fact, they're identical. But then Archer, of course, as you said, doesn't want to leave. You're looking to do all these swaps. Your buddy DeCilio always involved, as he is in every swap. This is just weird to me. This just seems like, I know that there are accounting tricks that would make swaps more favorable, but they're also difficult to do because you got to fit the wages together. I don't know. This whole thing just seems so odd to me. I suppose Rakitic saying that he still watches every Sevilla game and would love going back there, maybe that's encouraging.
Yeah.
But again, and I say this time and again, the big clubs pay so much in wages that we're reaching a point, especially now, where all they can do is just swap players with each other because nobody else can go and afford this. Jewel, something happier. Tell me about the European Solidarity Cup.
Yeah, very good initiative from Bayern Munich, Inter Milan and Real Madrid, Gab, who in 2021 will play three games between themselves, one in Munich, one in Milan and one in Madrid. To collect money and raise money for hospitals or the equivalent of the NHS in the three countries. They would invite nurses and doctors to watch the game. They would be in the stands. And I think it's just great. And I think for all the discussions and some of the negativity around this situation, there has also been a lot of very positive things made by club and by clubs all around Europe, all around the world. And this is another one, which I think in 2021 is going to work really well. So well done to Bayern, Real Madrid and Inter Milan.
Tremendous PR, certainly.
No, it's good. But even, you know, even outside of the PR.
Yeah, it can make tangible, and can make a tangible difference, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, from Ibra to Rangnick to Donnarumma, Milan have some big decisions ahead.
Yeah, that's right. So obviously Ibrahimovic is out of contract. Donnarumma is out of contract summer after next, which means that you either extend them or you sell them now, get a little bit of money if you can, or you lose them for free. Rangnick coming in as some kind of super manager, also in charge of recruitment and also coaching, or do you stick with Pioli? And all of this is happening, of course, as they prepare to go back to play and what is really important to them because, you know, they need to get into Europe. So I don't know which way this is going to end. They're also going to have to decide, you know, do we bend over backwards to keep Paolo Maldini, try to, you know, keep him inside the tent pissing out or have him outside the tent pissing in? I don't know. There's just so much going on.
So much, yeah.
I think, though, all these things are just further evidence that, you know, you pay for stupid decisions and bad decisions made by incompetent people in the past, because these owners have made some mistakes, but most of this mess is just crap that they've inherited. Jules, another transfer story. A lot of buzz. Thomas Partey for Alexandre Lacazette. That is the rumored swap and the subject of swaps that we've heard.
Yeah.
Arsenal already have another center forward, and you could get 30-year-old Lacazette and all his big wages off the books, and Thomas Partey is a good guy who can play midfield, and, you know, Arsenal have Granit Xhaka. Win-win for both sides, right? Since Atleti need a striker.
Right. Atletico need a striker. And if you remember...
Diego Costa, Morata, none of these guys are good enough for you, right? They need...
No, it's not that.
That 30-year-old Alexandre Lacazette.
Well, he's not 30 yet. Please. He's still in his 20s. I don't care. And they wanted him when he was at Lyon. And they could not sign him because of the transfer ban. So he went to Arsenal as well. And now I could see why, because Atleti looking for a striker and they've been linked with Cavani, for example, like they were in January. And obviously with the pandemic and with what Javier Tebas has been saying, won't be able to spend, even if they had the money, 50 or 100 million euros on someone. So maybe swaps is a good idea, and swap is certainly what Arsenal are looking to do, loans or swap, because again, similar situation, money is an issue for the summer if you want to do big transfers and you won't be able to. So that, I think that's where it is at now. Partey has a release clause of 50 million euros. Is that the value of Lacazette? I'm not sure.
I still think
those kind of swaps are very hard to do. I don't even know if that's what Arsenal wants and Atletico want, and if that's what Lacazette wants and Partey wants as well. But I still think they're very hard to make those. Well, finally, Gab, our friend Yana Gafiotov on the show on Monday stood up for his mate and fellow Norwegian Erling Haaland on some of the criticism. If you remember that there was over the weekend on some of an interview that he gave after the game against Schalke, which was actually not the whole interview.
Yeah, and there was a supercut that people made of him. I mean, some of them were when he was still at Salzburg, some at Dortmund, where, you know, they ask him a question and he gives a one-word answer, you know. And it's kind of like, oh, look, isn't this guy, you know, rude and a bit of a lunk and incapable of talking to the media? Now, if you want a different version of it, he gave an interview, obviously, with our colleague Alexis Nunez. So go check that on the site. Jan made the point that, you know, you can selectively edit anybody's interviews to go and make them look like idiots, or make them seem rude and weird. This was all started because a couple of people in the media here in England retweeted it and says, oh, what a shame if he doesn't respect, you know, the media doesn't learn to be a star. And I mean, first of all, you see Lionel Messi interviewed? I mean, not exactly the most forthcoming guy.
Locatious, yeah.
But also even Wayne Rooney. When Wayne Rooney was 19, 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, people made fun of him because he was shy and he was awkward in interviews, right? I'm not saying Wayne Rooney is a university professor now, but now that he's older and more confident, he speaks, and he often speaks well, and he often says some interesting things. He writes a column, in the Times where he raises some important issues.
Yeah.
Why don't we just chill the hell out and realize
that... Why are people on their cases like that?
Erling Haaland is 19 years old. Maybe he hasn't had all the media training that others have said. But, you know, there's no need to go and start tearing him down now.
Definitely not.
Final point on this, I urge everybody to go out there and check out Tom Hamilton's feature story on the former Juventus and Portsmouth striker, Vincent Pericard. It's a bizarre story.
It's a great story, yeah. I mean, great in the sense of there was everything, drama. He's a prodigious player. When he was younger, he was incredible. And then maybe left too early to go to Juventus when things, and he explains it very well, mostly after one text went really, really wrong. And then the negative spiral started. And then from there was just no end of the tunnel for him. And he's a lovely, lovely guy, not just because he's Parisian and French, like me, but more seriously, really, really great guy. And again, I think the story is to show other people this could happen as well. Yes, of course, football players and the best ones earn a lot of money and have a great life, but you could also look like you're going to be one of them and actually have a completely different life and completely different career. And that was his case. So
he's also I think helped develop an app dealing with mental health issues. And you know, it is Mental Health Week, I believe.
Yeah.
So definitely worth reading. Well written story by our colleague Tom Hamilton. All right, how about some Alphabet 11?
Yes, it was the R team today, and thank you to everyone who sent the team much more answers than the Q team that all of you pretty much failed.
There's a shock,
but the R team, obviously loads of names in there, and some really interesting one. We start with Dean Kempster, who sends his team Romero in goal, Rafael, Ramos, Rudiger, and Robertson as a back four, pretty strong back four, Ramsey, Rakitic and Rodri in midfield, and then a front three that you would really like, Ronaldo, Rashford and Marco Reus. Ramzi Haddad has a mixed men and women 11, which I thought was really good. Matty Ryan in goal, Wendy Renard at the back with Romagnoli, Sergi Roberto and Robertson, Jill Roord, the Dutch midfielder with Fabian Ruiz and Rodri, and up front, Reus, Ronaldo and Megan Rapinoe. I mean, how much would Rapinoe love to play with Ronaldo and Marco Reus as well? We've got Ayo Fazli, who sends his 3-5-2 with Pepe Reina in goal, Sergi Roberto, Rudiger, Romagnoli, Ramos, Robertson, Rodri, James Rodriguez, I guess he counts Reus, Ronaldo and Rashford, and maybe one more. Danny Ackland has Rashkovic in goal from Reims, Roberto, Rugani, Rudiger, Robertson, Rafinha and Rodriguez from Betis, James Rodriguez from Real Madrid, and then Reus, Ronaldo and Rashford, which seems to be the most common front three.
Funny enough, that's not my front three, but you're going to have to wait a little bit longer to hear it. Women's 11s. How about this from Sophie Lawson? We got Ellie Roebuck in goal across the back, Ali Riley, Stine Reynas, Wendy Renard, Kenty Robles, midfield with Guro Reiten, Vilde Borisa, or Vilde Borisa, I assume Risa's the last name, Ellen Rubinson, and then up front, obviously, Megan Rapinoe, no surprise there, Rocky Rodriguez, and Haley Russell.
Wow, so Miguel Galan sent his as well, and his is only a North America / CONCACAF Women 11, which is pretty good. He's got Roland in goal, Robles, Romero, Reynolds, and Rodriguez at the back from Mexico, the US, and Costa Rica. Rangel, Rocaro, and Rodriguez in midfield three. And then up front, Dean Rose from Canada, Amy Rodriguez, and Megan Rapinoe, which is pretty good. Talking about Rodriguez, we've had a couple of our listeners sending full Rodriguez teams, like Aniket, who's got Jose Rodriguez from Guadalajara, Kappa Rodriguez from Bilbao, Alberto Rodriguez from Lima, and Ricardo Rodriguez at the back, Luis from Tigres, Guido from Betis, Gary Rodriguez from Fenerbahce, and Kevin Rodriguez from Leganés, James from Real Madrid, and then the front two of Che Rodriguez from Burnley and Angel Rodriguez from Getafe. Pretty well done from Aniket. What about yours, Gab? What's your team?
All right, my R team, I was so tempted to put Pepe Reina in there. I said, no, why don't I give a shout out to a guy I consider to be a highly underrated French goalkeeper, Mr. Ruthier, is in goal.
Oh, nice, nice.
At the back, I have Rafinha from Libertadores champions Flamengo,
yes,
with Sergio Ramos and Antonio Rudiger. I was this close to putting Romagnoli in there, but then
I'm surprised you haven't.
I know. But Antonio Rudiger, he's on that list of good Germans with Albert Einstein.
Yes.
And can't come up with any others right now.
Yeah,
but,
and Raphael Honigstein. Yeah,
Raphael, yes, that's right. And then left back, Andy Robertson, of course.
Yeah.
In midfield, I have another German, Sebastian Rudi. And he's joined.
What?
What?
Sebastian Rudi is in your R team.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, I need a defensive midfielder.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Go on.
He's joined, of course, by Aaron Ramsey and Mr. Rakitic.
And okay, so no Rodri, no people. You felt like Rudi ahead of Rodri.
Rodri's last name is Hernandez, by the way.
Okay.
And then up front, yeah. All right. If you want to put Rodri in for Rakitic or make it more defensive, that's fine. And then we can play.
No.
Come on.
Your
then team. Up front, Marco Reus, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Another Frenchman! Franck Ribéry!
Yes, of
Come
course.
Come on, you gotta have him.
Of course,
you gotta have him.
He's in
News
my
Red's
team
buddy,
as well.
Man.
Yeah, he's in
well,
my team.
I heard
as
that
well.
When he's gonna retire in about 7 years, he's gonna go and join News Red, and they're gonna go and pounce around the kitchen together with their little salt things and everything, and he's gonna learn to play with knives.
Yeah, yeah. That's
I'm
the idea.
To that.
That's the idea. So my R team, I need to point out first, one of my children is called Raphael. That just gives you an hint. It gives you a hint. And also, Mrs. L being Welsh, you know, I need Aaron Ramsey, who's a friend of the family, in this team. So, Rajkovic in goal, best goalkeeper in Ligue 1, the Reims goalkeeper, will be there. Rafael, the Lyon and Brazil right back, even if he was mean to Neymar earlier, a few weeks ago, I still need him because of my son in there. Ramos, Romagnoli and Robertson at the back. As my defensive midfielder, I've got Marc Roca, which I think is a very underrated, great player and soon to be in a big, big team. Rabiot, obviously. And Aaron Ramsey.
I need somebody with big hair and a weird mom who acts weird.
Rabiot grew up where I grew up. So he's just there. Has to be there. And then my front three.
Boys, man. Right.
My front three is Rafa Silva, obviously. Rafa again. Marcus Rashford and Franck Ribéry. There's no room for Cristiano in my team. I'm sorry, Cristiano.
There you go. All right. Shall we move on to the letter S next week?
Yeah, S on Monday. So hit us up with your teams, people, and then we pick the best one for the show again on Monday.
Nobody put Wayne Rooney in the team, which is pretty disappointing. By
I know.
Way.
I thought about him, and then I went, nah.
Come on. Why? Sorry. That could have happened in the midfield. All right, that's all we got time for. Stay out there, stay safe, stay alert.
Stay
no, don't
alert.
Stay out there. Stay indoors. If Serge Aurier's hairdresser knocks on your door, do not let him in. We picked on Serge Aurier, yeah. But I feel like we let his hairdresser, Gilles, off the hook, and that's not
yes.
really fair, is it?
Yeah. No, it's not really fair. But, you know, one last thing before we let you go. For the people who cannot see or won't see the videos that we will be put by Freddie on the website, Gab is wearing a cap this morning. And I would like him now to take the cap off just to see the state of the hair underneath. And then I can
hopefully my hair is all flattened
testify.
Now from the cap.
Yes. Just wear the cap back. Just
put it back. I know. Otherwise I might have to call Gio. All right. Till Monday.